Thank you very much for those nice words, Lynn and Shirley. Of course, it's a great thrill for Hank. Hank, why don't you wave at everybody? For Hank and me to be here, there's no place closer to our hearts, I think, than Hyde Park, because we have been here quite a bit at the Roosevelt Library, and because we have such interest in researching the Roosevelts and the era in which they lived, and the era that they played such important parts in. It's just such a great honor to be here. Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, served to help me make my own history. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. But I surmise she had an impact on many of this room. How many of you met her? Just one person? Oh, well, when we get to the questions and answers, we'll have to have you tell us about that. How many of you would say that your interest in the Roosevelts had had an impact on your own lives? I would have thought so. So I do want to thank Cliff Lobby of the Roosevelt Library, Lynn Bassinet, the acting director, Shirley Adams of the Catherine Street Community Center, and the other good folks there for asking Hank and me to come here today. And I want to do something to get us back in the Roosevelt era. Wish to put on my Eleanor Roosevelt necktie. How many of you remember when ladies wore these? Yeah, this is an era of fur neck pieces and of big and sort of crazy hats that women wore, and matronly outfits. And this is what women wore while leading rather restrictive lives. Please join me in picturing a scene in which I tell you a little bit about how I think Eleanor helped me make my own history. This is a drafty old house in a small town in Missouri. Here's an exhausted housewife trying to keep warm over a hot air register at the end of a dull day of housekeeping while reading her favorite columnist in the Kansas City Star. Suddenly she looks at her little girl playing nearby and says, "I am sure that she is better than he is." I think you can guess the she was Eleanor and the he was Franklin. My family was rock-ribbed Republicans. The Tea Party would have had nothing on them. But my mother loved reading Eleanor's My Day column. My mother was one of those women who had to give up a career. She'd been a school teacher until she got married in 1933. And when she told the superintendent of schools that she was leaving to get married, he said, "I might have known it, Miss Hieronymus," that was her name, "what I have left is those who are wanted neither by God nor man." It's a horrible comment to make about unmarried women school teachers, but it also shows you something about the limitations on life for women in those days. And this is something that Eleanor, I think, helped change, which I'll try to talk to you about. But women, you know, really, if they got married, they were supposed to devote themselves to housekeeping, which my mother thought was extremely boring. So she loved to read Eleanor's My Day column. And she saw a woman who was actually going out and doing things, meeting people, going places. And I think that stimulated my own interest in getting an education and moving outside the boundaries of a small town. Eleanor's examples stimulated a lot of other women, too, and for years she has ranked in polls as the single most admired American woman. Years later, when I was asked to by Lou Gould, the editor of the Modern American First Lady series, to write a biography concentrating on how Eleanor Roosevelt changed the role of the First Lady, I tried to imagine how this role looked for Eleanor at the time Franklin was elected, and I tried to imagine how she viewed herself in the White House. Of course, Eleanor had experience with the White House. After all, she was a Roosevelt before she married Franklin, her fifth cousin once removed. Her uncle was Teddy Roosevelt, President of the United States. Eleanor had visited in the White House. White House was not unknown to her. But we know from a tremendous amount of historical evidence, Eleanor did not want to be First Lady. Now, she certainly did everything she could to help advance Franklin's candidacy for the presidency in 1932, but she was not enthusiastic about this role, and she is supposed to have said, I don't want to just sit in the White House and pour tea. In fact, there's even an example of a lost letter in which she gives her a tremendous emotional dislike of the position of First Lady, and even talks about possibly running off and getting away from this responsibility. So why did she look at the job of First Lady, which I think to most people would look like a pretty interesting sort of thing to do, with such trepidation? Well, Eleanor didn't fit the mold in a way of her predecessors. Her predecessors had been certainly hostesses. They had been to some degree helpmates for their husbands, depending on which woman you're looking at, and some of them had certainly been unofficial advisors. But Eleanor wasn't Franklin's closest advisor, as she might have liked to have been. She didn't hesitate to offer him her opinions, but he might or might not accept them. And so when Franklin was elected, she went to Franklin and she said, Franklin, could I take care of your mail for you? And he said, no, that's Missy's job, Missy Lehan, his secretary. So she didn't have that to occupy herself with, and she was really afraid that she wouldn't find much to do in the White House, so she decided that she would busy herself with writing. She had already started a career as a writer in the 1920s. So now, how do we get to the point where Eleanor's accomplishment as a president's wife is to make her own history as First Lady from 1933 to 1945 and to rewrite the script for all First Ladies since? Now, it's a script that her successors have had to take note of. Some of them have not followed it, but all of them have more or less followed parts of it. How did she manage to make the First Lady's position part of the American presidency, as it really is today, part of the White House political communication process, when she went into it with such fear and trepidation? Well, in the book I wrote, I try to tell that story and point out how much she drew from a rather small group of close personal friends. I'll get back to my mother. What made Eleanor Roosevelt, an upper-class patrician, relate to a person of an ordinary American like my mother in a little town in Missouri? Did Eleanor have a lot of professional public relations advisors, as our political figures do today? Did she have people who told her how to spin things this way or that way? No, she did it herself. But she did have some people who inspired and who helped her, and I'd like to talk about that a bit. But mainly, of course, Eleanor had a lively intelligence and a genuine interest in others. And she drew from the people around her. So let me show you a few slides that will illustrate what I'm trying to say. Here we see
Eleanor and Franklin. And who do we see in the middle there? Mama, Eleanor's mother-in-law. This picture was taken in 1905, shortly after the Roosevelts were married. But you can see that Franklin and Sarah seem to be communing with each other, and Eleanor looks sort of left out. Now, we're going to move on to the 1930s. Of course, we know that Eleanor and Franklin lived increasingly separate lives from 1918 on, after she discovered his romance with Lucy Mercer during World War I, but that they stayed together, partly because Sarah, the mother-in-law, controlled the money for the Roosevelt family, and she is supposed to have said something to Franklin like, "Look, Franklin, you leave Eleanor and those five children, and that's it. I'll cut off the funds." So that perhaps was a factor in their desire to remain married, at least in terms of public appearances. We know that Eleanor nursed Franklin with the greatest of care when he was stricken with infantile paralysis in 1921, and that he actually never really walked again since after that point. We know that when Franklin was elected governor of New York in 1928, in spite of his inability to walk, which was more or less, depending on how you want to read the record, not known to people, Eleanor by then was busy with her own career. She was teaching at New York's Todd Hunter School, and she was writing. She's writing articles for women's magazines on such topics as women should learn to play the game of politics like men do. Women should get involved in their community, that kind of thing. And we know that at that point she accepted the role of his secretary, Missy Lehan, as a kind of surrogate wife who could fill in for her and provide Franklin with companionship while she was off doing her own thing. And at this time, too, we know that Eleanor found companionship of her own with Earl Miller, a highway patrolman assigned as her bodyguard. Now, here the four lounge by the Valkill Pool about 1930. See, here's Earl Miller, athletic-looking fellow. There's Missy Lehan next. There's Franklin. And there's Eleanor on the end. And here we see Eleanor and Earl Miller in a home movie that was taken here at Valkill. And we see that Earl is playing a pirate about to kidnap Eleanor. Well, what do we gain out of this? I think we gain the fact that Earl Miller was a friend who helped Eleanor relax. He was someone who was able to relate to her in a different way than members of her family could or did. Now, Earl Miller was not from the upper crust. Hell, he was an earthy individual, a former circus acrobat, who gave Eleanor self-confidence in herself and helped her break through the bounds surrounding the idea of an aristocratic lady. Now, once in the White House, Eleanor did, of course, play a ceremonial role. But the point of this book that I wrote is the way she moved outside that ceremonial role and did so many things that her predecessors had not done. Here we see her, however, in a ceremonial setup. This is her inaugural reception outfit. This is 1937 rather than a little earlier, but it's the same kind of thing she did in 33 and 34, too. Here, this is a heavily retouched photo, I think. Actually, it's from the collection of the Library of Congress. But she is in a gown from Arnold Constable, a New York department store, and they had an arrangement with her in which she would pose in their new clothes, and newspaper photographers would take pictures of her, and then, you know, these pictures would be distributed to the country. Here's Eleanor in her Arnold Constable outfit for such and such an event. So she did do some of this, and in fact, how many of you know this? She was on the best dress list for 1934. However, there was another side here. Now, I said that Eleanor was a great friend of Earl Miller. She was, of course, and Earl Miller gave her a lot of self-confidence in the early 30s, the period before Franklin was elected president in 1932. Did Earl Miller go with the Roosevelt entourage to Washington? No. Franklin wouldn't allow it, among other things. But the Roosevelt administration found a nice job for Earl Miller in New York. However, Earl did give her some of the confidence to do things as First Lady. One of the things that Earl Miller did for her was to show her how to shoot a gun. Eleanor declined Secret Service protection. Now, of course, the First Lady today couldn't do that, but Eleanor could. She said, I won't have a Secret Service following me around. So Earl showed her how to shoot a gun, and she kept a gun in the glove compartment of her car. Now, Earl is not on the scene anymore, although she and Earl continued to be friendly. The whole period she was First Lady, she would visit him at his house. She would help arrange things in his homes. She would give him presents. They went for long walks together in the snow, that kind of thing. So they were friendly. But in Eleanor's scheme of really close associates, the time she got to the White House, her closest associate is Lorena Hickok. Now, if I can point this right, yeah, Cliff, I'm not doing it right. Yeah, I got the button right in the middle. I'm trying to show you Lorena Hickok. She is in this picture. Well, anyway, you see Eleanor standing there. Okay. Here she's over there. Can you point there? Thank you. Well, it's right.
Yeah, but you need to. Whoops, sorry. I'm advancing now. Hold on.
We'll get it back. Okay.
So you just need to point it. There you go.
Okay. Here's Lorena Hickok. And she and Eleanor are standing beside the car that Eleanor drove when the two of them went off on a summer vacation by themselves in 1933. Now, today, imagine the First Lady going off by vacation by herself without any newspaper people following her around or trying to determine what she was doing. The press let Eleanor alone, partly because she had made such good friends with the women who were covering her in the Washington Press Corps. They took a summer vacation trip in 33 by themselves up through New England and into Canada. And then in 34, they went out west, Yosemite. Lorena Hickok became her most trusted advisor in this period. And in my research, I've concluded that Lorena had a tremendous impact on the way Eleanor did transform the role of First Ladies. It was Lorena Hickok who was the top woman political writer for the Associated Press, who covered Eleanor during Franklin's long campaign trips by train in 1932. And of course, Eleanor went along. She certainly helped Franklin in campaigning to the extent that it was considered appropriate for a woman to do so at that time. And she and Lorena just became extremely intimate friends. Now, Loretta Hickok gave Eleanor Roosevelt the idea of having press conferences for women reporters only. And she had 347 of them during the 12 years she was first lady, from 1933 to 1945. She would see the press women almost weekly when she was in Washington. Of course, she traveled around a lot, so she wasn't always there. But she did see them when she was there. And here are a group of the women who were the most devoted to her. And these are press women who went with her on a trip to Puerto Rico in 1934. It's the first time a first lady had traveled outside the continental limits of the United States while her husband was in office. These women represented... there's Emma Bugby there on the end representing the New York Herald Tribune. Next woman represented, Dorothy Dukas represented a Hearst news service. Here's Eleanor in the middle. There's Ruby Black, who was practically Eleanor's press agent and who wrote Eleanor's first biography published in 1940 and who operated her, her own news bureau but also worked for United Press. And then on the end, Bess Furman, another woman who worked for the Associated Press first and then later for the New York Times. These women worshipped Eleanor, and they went along with her on this trip to Puerto Rico. And here we see Eleanor with Loretta Hickok in Puerto Rico. Loretta Hickok is the woman with the long scarf. And you can see them walking along a dirty street in San Juan. They are there to inspect poverty and report on conditions in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. But this time, Hickok has left the Associated Press and is working directly for the Roosevelt administration as an undercover investigator of relief and welfare programs. But actually, Eleanor is letting her live in the White House, too, so she doesn't have to pay rent. So she and Eleanor continue to be very friendly. Now, we know that Loretta Hickok was a lesbian. We know that Eleanor and she had a very strong emotional relationship. To what degree this is a physical relationship, I'm sure I wouldn't know. I don't think anybody knows exactly either. And I don't think that's the point. The point is that Hickok really helped Eleanor with her communication to America. She helped her by helping arrange these press conferences. These women were so grateful to have something to write about because the men usually gave them extremely poor assignments or tried to fire them or wouldn't even hire them to begin with. So they were grateful to Eleanor, and they featured her in numerous newspaper articles as a path-breaking first lady. And they gave great attention to the kinds of things that Eleanor did. By the time Eleanor started in these press conferences and started traveling around on behalf of the Roosevelt administration, she began to see the possibilities in the role of first lady. In fact, in this book, I've got to read you my favorite quotation here. It's from an usher, J.B. West, at the White House, and he recalling Eleanor there, recalling her racing through the White House, skirts flapping around her legs. On her way to numerous appointments, West remembered, she would jump into her waiting car and call out to the driver, "Where am I going?" And on her way back, she gathered up people to bring home to lunch. He said she sometimes invited so many, she forgot who they were. So anyway, Eleanor really gets into the business of being first lady because she begins to realize that she can do with the position of first lady what her uncle, Teddy Roosevelt, did with the position of president. And we know that Teddy said, "Oh, it's being president is a bully pulpit." And so she made the job of first lady into a bully pulpit too. But it was a different kind of bully pulpit. It was a kind of bully pulpit that was acceptable for an era in which ladies wore things like this. Lorena Hickok would help Eleanor in the editing of her magazine articles. Eleanor would send her these pieces that she wrote, and they were generally on topics like, oh, a day in the life of a first lady, or life at the White House, or things like that. Citizenship. They were not revolutionary political treatises by any matter of means. They were pieces that spoke to average women. And, of course, Eleanor Roosevelt had these advice columns that ran in, first the Women's Home Companion, then the Ladies' Home Journal, and later McCall's. Does anybody remember any of her advice columns? Oh, I do, again, because I would read them, and I remember one which somebody wrote in and said, Mrs. Roosevelt, what about women smoking? And Eleanor said, well, you know, I don't smoke, but I do provide cigarettes for those who want them, so forth. But she did say, I don't smoke. And I know that made an impact on me. I don't think that was the reason altogether that I've never smoked, but it's part of it. And I'm very grateful for that, believe me. Now, what about these magazine articles that she was doing? Did she do them free? Oh, no. Now, she had to give up her job teaching at Todd Hunter to be first lady, to do the ceremonial things that a first lady had to do. And also, we've got to remember, too, that behind the scenes, she continued her political involvement with women in the Democratic Party. Behind the scenes, she worked with Molly Dewson and others to try to find jobs in the New Deal for qualified women. But that was a bit of a sub rosa thing. However, she did it. But she insisted on getting paid for the magazine articles that she wrote, and later for her My Day column. In fact, Lorena Hickok may have given her the idea for this My Day column, which was a diary of her activities. And this was the column that my mother read. How many of you ever read the My Day column? Okay, you remember what it was like. Just let me read you a little bit of one. Wednesday. This one is headlined, I felt very guilty to have missed my hostess, by Eleanor Roosevelt. Wednesday. Washington has bloomed considerably in the week that I have been away, and it seems much more like spring here than it did in New York State. Well, golly, that's not a really intense piece of writing. It's sort of the kind of thing that one neighbor says to another. And that's why it spoke to people. Because the tenor of the times and the fact that the Roosevelt administration was under tremendous criticism from its political opponents, if Eleanor had written too much on controversial topics, I don't think this column would have flown. But she didn't. So anyway, she says, well, at 10:30 this morning, I went out to the University of Maryland to give a talk. Because this is a land-grant college, they have quite a large military force. I drove up to the front of the auditorium mainly because I was impressed by the number of boys in uniform standing outside the door. Nobody seemed to be expecting me, nor was there anyone to tell me where to go. Well, she goes on to say that the Dean of Women had tried to meet her at the district line, but they had missed her in her car. See, Eleanor's driving around in her car by herself. Imagine that. Think of the security today that attends those who are the occupants of the White House. But you see the conversational tone. Why would my mother find that so interesting? Well, she goes on to talk about meeting the officials of the University of Maryland, giving a talk there on citizenship. And then she says she goes back to the White House, and only two guests for lunch today. One of them, Mrs. Waterstreet, comes from Wisconsin and does programs which impersonate various ladies who have lived in the White House. My mother thought that was really interesting, you know. And the column went on like that. It had a very personal tone to it. Was it laughed at by men journalists? Oh, yes. Was it parodied? Oh, yes. But it's sort of like a very popular form of communication today. A blog, yes. Exactly. It's like a blog. And it spoke to people in a way that I think a more sophisticated political treatise would have not. Of course, Eleanor is continuing while she is doing all this to be the First Lady. But now I said that she made money out of this column. Well, she didn't. She made money out of her magazine articles. In fact, due to my dear husband, who has gone through her income tax return forms very carefully, and they are here in the Roosevelt Library, you can conclude that she had an income over the 12 years that she was in the White House of about $70,000 a year. $70,000 a year for a woman in those days was something, particularly when you realize that Franklin's salary as president was only $75,000. See, she was doing pretty well. Now, how did she get away with this? Well, of course, she gave a lot of this money away to charity, but she didn't give it all away. And she wasn't terribly forthright in telling people, well, yes, I made this and that. Although there is a wonderful story, which I don't believe, but it's still a story that's been passed out, down, that when she sold the first installment of her autobiography to the Ladies' Home Journal, in 1937, she's supposed to have gone through the White House waving the $75,000 check she got from the Ladies' Home Journal, saying, look at this, this is mine, I made as much as Franklin did. So I don't really believe that, but still, I think scholars would say that there is considerable evidence that there was rivalry there between Franklin and Eleanor these White House years. But Eleanor also is making history by showing that a married woman, had a right to make money. And I think that's one of the things that sort of resonated with my mother, because that was known. And some of the women, particularly Ruby Black, who covered the press conferences for the United Press, made a point of that and sent out dispatches on that Eleanor, as First Lady, said it was all right for married women to work. This was an age when married women were not supposed to work, on a theory being that they would take jobs away from men. But here is Eleanor in the ceremonial role. This is the official White House Christmas card of 1933, and she and Franklin obviously are posing for that. She was making history, though, in other ways besides her writing. She was making history in showing her belief in social issues and in various causes. Now, here she is visiting Howard University in 1936, and these young men are dressed up in ROTC uniforms. This picture caused a great outcry from segregationists who used it to attack the racial policies of the Roosevelt administration. Pictures like this were publicized in the African-American press of the day, and they played a role in getting the African-Americans to switch their political allegiance, those who were allowed to vote, from the Republican Party of Lincoln to the Democratic Party of Roosevelt. Here she is traveling with giving lectures. Now, she got a lot of money for her lectures. She gave paid lectures. She also spoke, of course, free for many, many times. But she did do paid lectures before big people, big crowds. She talks in one letter about, gee, could I really fill an auditorium with 16,000 people? But she did. This is her secretary over there, Malvina Thompson, and sometimes just the two of them would be traveling to these lectures. Eleanor also was ahead of her times in other ways. She could not have gotten around so much if she had not liked to fly. She was one of the first women to really appreciate commercial aviation. And this picture, a rare color picture taken by her son John in 1936, shows her knitting. Remember, she always knitted. She's knitting while on an airplane. And this was used in advertising by the airline industry to try to promote flying to women. Now, because we want time for questions, I'm going to move rather rapidly through some of these other slides, showing her again doing things in which she is making history. Here she is in 1940. She is speaking at the Democratic National Convention, calming down delegates who did not want Henry Wallace to be FDR's vice presidential running mate in 1940. Now, here we are in the Wallace Center, so we can conclude that she was quite successful in her speech. She's still doing the ceremonial things, too. Here she is on a battleship, inspecting it with FDR, just prior to World War II. And who do we have over here who's also along? Mama, Sarah Roosevelt, who frequently visited in the White House. And then we have James Roosevelt, the oldest of Roosevelt's son, and his wife, Betsy, who are also there. How much of an impact did her family have on her as she transformed the role of the First Lady? Well, obviously, Franklin had an impact. I don't think the children, however, did so much have an impact. I think it was more her personal relationships with Earl Miller, Lorena Hickok, and another person I'll mention in a minute. Here on a more substantial mission than inspecting the battleship, she is addressing a national conference on the problems of Negro youth in 1939 with Audrey Williams and Mary McLeod Bethune of the National Youth Administration. Do any of you remember the NYA? Because sometimes I speak to people and they say, oh yeah, that's how I got through high school, or that's how I got through college. This is a program to help people stay in school in a period when young people were having a terrible time. NYA was one of the most successful of the New Deal agencies, and Eleanor was instrumental in helping set it up. She certainly lobbied FDR on its behalf. It tried to help impoverished young people stay in school, since at least a third of the population was more or less impoverished. There was a lot of people. Also, it had programs for students who were unemployed and who were out of school. FDR, in fact, referred to the NYA as the Mrs. Organization. And here she is at Campobello in July 1942 at a summer leadership training institute of the International Student Service. Now, we see a group of young people there, and it's very interesting. This is an integrated group, and that's a period when integration was not very common. The General Secretary, who unfortunately is not in that picture, of the International Student Service was a young man named Joe Lash. Lash was a student leader involved in leftist student organizations in the period right before World War II. He was pretty close to the Communist Party, if not a member, and then he split with that, got disillusioned with the Communists, and he became a rabid anti-communist. He and Eleanor were extremely close in this period. She had let her relationship with Hickok wane, or Hickok, I don't know, had fallen out of I wouldn't say out of favor with Eleanor, but the two women just weren't on the same wavelength anymore. And Eleanor's closest personal relationship at this time really seemed to be with Joe Laish. They had a moral affinity for each other, Laish said. E.R. benefited from Laish's political savvy. He educated and warned her about the dangers of communists. And, pardon me, she later used this knowledge when she was at the United Nations and actually dealing with the Russians. Of course, Laish wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning Eleanor and Franklin, one of the first influential biographies of Eleanor. Okay, now during World War II, she travels a lot. She's accustomed to making the role of First Lady one of real political significance, traveling as an ambassador for the Roosevelt administration. Here she is visiting enlisted men on a base in Galapagos Island off the coast of Ecuador and Latin America. Here she is inspecting troops in England. Certainly no First Lady before her would have ever done anything like this. And back here in Washington, once again, she's showing her interest in racial issues. Here she and Mrs. Bethune are attending an opening ceremony of a residence for African-American women war workers. And at the White House, she continues to have a ceremonial role when she's there. In fact, one newspaper even wrote a headline, Mrs. Roosevelt at the White House, because she was away so much. Here she is entertaining Madame Chiang Kai-shek of China in 1943. Well, we know the end of the story. We know that FDR died unexpectedly in 1945. We know Eleanor was appointed U.S. delegate to the United Nations, and that she became the moving spirit behind the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And in doing so, she certainly drew on her experiences in the White House, especially those, I think, involving the political issues that she and Joe Laish had discussed. Time doesn't permit me, of course, to go into a lot of other things she did in the White House, but I will note she had an unsuccessful appointment as the Assistant Director of the Office of Civil Defense for about 5 months, 1941-1942. She made some mistakes there, and some of the people she appointed to her job and all that. And so she resigned under great press pressure to do so. However, she wrote in her My Day column about that. People can gradually be brought to understand that an individual, even if she is a president's wife, may have independent views and must be allowed the expression of an opinion. But actual participation in the work of the government, we are not able to accept. So she felt she was hounded out because of her position as the president's wife. In fact, 1945, after FDR dies, she also writes in My Day, "A woman will always have to be better than a man in any job she undertakes." Eleanor, had her own ideas on sexism. Well, now, She made history, however, because she did take a position that she did not want, and she transformed it into one that's important part of the American presidency. I think I'll just end with this, and then I certainly hope you'll have some questions. What she said in a book she wrote in 1960, you learn by living, you gain strength, courage, and confidence by every experience in which you really stop to look fear in the face. You must do the thing you think you cannot do. So here's a woman who thought she couldn't be a first lady, and it turns out that she's the most remarkable first lady of all times. Thank you. Before we take questions, I'd like to ask this lady to tell us about meeting Eleanor Roosevelt. Could you do that for us?
Well, I met Mrs. Roosevelt because my husband went to Bard College, and he did his undergraduate thesis on Wilbert School for Boys. That was one of Mrs. Roosevelt's pet projects.
Would you like to tell us what that was? This group may know, but perhaps someone doesn't.
There was a school for really for underprivileged boys, but Mrs. Roosevelt used to say there were boys that needed special attention. Floyd Patterson was one of the fellows that went there. And Claude Brown, the young man that wrote he dedicated that book to Mrs. Roosevelt.
Man-Child and
the Promised Land. Yeah, he dedicated that to Mrs. Roosevelt. But he was also one of those fellows that went to Bard College. And that's how I met Mrs. Roosevelt. She was, as I said, Mrs. Roosevelt was one of the few people that I know. She was for desegregation before it became popular.
Mm-hmm.
Because she did the talk, but she did the walk. You know, she said she was for the human race, and she was for the human race. Mm-hmm. So she made sure that my husband got everything that he needed for his project. So that's why she used to invite us for dinners and teas and different things, the picnics and things. And I also belonged to St. James Church, and Mrs. Roosevelt was one of those, went to St. James Church. And I'm very fortunate because in 1962, a few months before Mrs. Roosevelt passed, my daughter was confirmed, and I have a picture of my daughter in her confirmation outfit.
So
Mrs. Roosevelt is one of the greatest people that I have really known. Oh, by the way, one of my cousins was a Tuskegee Flyers. So when he came back home, which was Durham, North Carolina, he told us how great Mrs. Roosevelt was. But I only knew Mrs. Roosevelt then as being a first lady. But when I met Mrs. Roosevelt, he really underestimated her because she was really a great lady.
Perhaps, you know, we might say that Eleanor had rather unconventional relationships with people who you might not expect her to have had relationships with, Earl Miller, Lorena Hickok, Joe Laish, but perhaps these unconventional relationships helped her develop this great love of people in general, a sort of a great love for humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Do we have other questions or comments? Yeah.
You spoke of the rivalry between Eleanor and Franklin, and I'm wondering about also the productivity of their particular partnership, that politically they were both politicians, and they were a very powerful team, it seems to me.
In fact, that's the way I started this book. I talked about Eleanor as a political figure and how politics were part of her life. I think that there's a tremendous amount of evidence that that's true. But she and Franklin, the White House, didn't really see all that much of each other. At night, she would go into his room before he went to bed, and she would talk to him about things. But during the day, they really led separate lives. And in the White House, she had her group, and he had his group of aides and associates. So I don't know, does that answer your question or perhaps not?
Well, no, I understand that she was an independent first lady. I don't know if there's even been a model for that kind of equivalent to her since.
Well, Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton to some extent, but very dependent on her husband's finances for her campaign. And it sort of went into the political tradition without a political family supporting her, whereas Eleanor, independent as a writer and as a thinker and as a social activist.
Yeah, but yes, but on the other hand, she wouldn't have been able to have done what she did if she hadn't been for Franklin. I mean, the two of them.
She had Teddy Roosevelt, though.
He was well, yeah, he was her uncle. Yeah, that's true.
But I guess, I don't think, would FDR have been a social progressive as much as a social progressive as he was if it were not for Eleanor?
I doubt it.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, and I don't think that the Roosevelt administration would have appealed to African Americans to the extent it did if it hadn't been for Eleanor, because she was much more progressive in that situation than Franklin was. He felt hamstrung by the Southern Democrats who controlled the key congressional committees. No, I think she pushed him. On civil rights, and yeah, she pushed him with the NRA to do something about young people. And I think, actually, Hickok, those reports that she wrote as an undercover investigator of relief conditions for the Roosevelt administration, I think they were quite instrumental, too, in getting the WPA underway and in showing FDR how important it was to try to take care of people. You know, today one of the things that kind of bothers me as a citizen, I don't think we talk enough about the people who are really not employed or who are so underemployed or who aren't getting even the minimum wage. You know, our political rhetoric doesn't seem to get into that vein. The reason that Franklin employed these undercover investigators is because he didn't think the newspapers of the time were really giving people a true picture of the Depression, the situation. He wanted more on what was actually going on in the communities where people were hurting. We have other comments or questions? People, yes.
Do you think that Eleanor thought that women are basically wiser than men are?
Well, let me tell you what she wrote. Here, this is from my day, March 6, 1937. As a rule, women know not only what men know, but much that men will never know. For how many men really know the heart and soul of a woman? So, I mean, that's what she said.
By the way, yeah. Did you know that women were not allowed to vote until 1920?
Yes, uh-huh. Yes.
But African-American men voted earlier.
Yes, in the parts, yeah, you know, if they were allowed to vote, the states that let him. Yeah, that's right. Yes. Women. And Eleanor was not a suffragist either. You know, she really didn't get into politics until the 1920s, after women did get the right to vote. And then she entered the political arena in the women's division of the Democratic Party in New York State. Yeah.
On that note, aren't I loud enough?
No.
Could you comment on the effect of Nancy Cook and Marion Dickerman on Mrs. Roosevelt's White House years?
Yes. Well, certainly Eleanor Roosevelt had quite a strong relationship with Nancy Cook and Marion Dickerman in the 1920s. Of course, they built Val Kill together and lived together. I don't think by the time she got to the White House, though, that Nancy Cook and Marion Dickerman were having that strong an impact on her. I think her friendship with them had begun to fray, and of course it ended rather unhappily.
Yes. What was the relationship between Mrs. Roosevelt
Frances Perkins?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. Eleanor was sometimes credited with persuading Franklin to make Frances Perkins Secretary of Labor, but I think there's a good deal of evidence that she really didn't have the defining decision-making on that point. Franklin wanted Frances Perkins. The rather recent biography of Frances Perkins has some information that Perkins was a little bit jealous of Eleanor later on in her later years because of all the money Eleanor made as First Lady. And Frances thought, my goodness, how remarkable that she used it to enrich herself that much. But they were friends, certainly. And there's an oral history of Frances Perkins in the Columbia University Oral History Collection, in which Frances Perkins talks about Eleanor sitting up at night in the mansion, governor's mansion in Albany, telling Frances, when Frances is staying all night there on business, about the Lucy Mercer affair, and about how terrible she felt about that. And Perkins is saying something like, well, she just had this compulsion to tell this and to relive this story. And I think you got the impression from that, or I got the impression when I read it, that Perkins was less the type of person who had a compulsion to tell her innermost thoughts. And she was kind of appalled. But they certainly knew each other, and certainly Eleanor was in favor of Frances being a Secretary of Labor, I think. I feel like I might be saying things that are wrong. And I hear that Lynn Bassett, and she knows so much about it, her years here. So correct me if I give you misinformation. Does anybody else have a question or a comment? Yes.
Did it appear to you that women's networks at that time were far more powerful than they are now?
Well, in a way, because Susan Ware, of course, of Harvard, the Fudger Library there, has written a wonderful book about women's political network during the New Deal era. And she talks about how Eleanor was sort of at the center of this political network. And Eleanor was working with Molly Dewson, and Molly Dewson was working with James Farley, the postmaster general, who was in charge of patronage for the Roosevelt administration, to try to get jobs for qualified women who were in the Democratic Party, but who also wanted work, but they wanted policy-making jobs, you know. And so these women were trying very hard to get Farley to find these jobs for the women. And I don't know that you'd have any network like that now. Of course, women are much more integrated into the whole political setup than they were then. Any other comments or questions?
Thank you.
So appreciate your comments.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure.